Hello, Dale speaking. This is India.
Dale speaking. This is Rue.
Dale speaking. This is Amber.
Ring, ring. Dale speaking.
You know, ginger ale is really just a form of root beer. Because ginger is a root and ale is a beer. Mm-hmm. So root beer and ginger ale.
You're clever.
Welcome to Radio Dale number 42.
This week in music history, which legendary club closed down?
This week on the charts, the top 10 Canadian albums.
This week on the campus report, the last 10 of the top 50.
This week's tech report.
This song of the week is about us.
And in part two, we have an interview with Andy Curran of SRO Anthem.
And a vampire.
And a vampire.
Interview with a vampire. Good movie. And now it's time for This Week in Music History, and I'm joined by my lovely friends, Rue and India.
Thanks, Amber.
Oh. No problem. Oh. So let's jump right into it. So October 10th, 1902, the Gibson Mandolin Guitar Company was formed.
Wow!
Gibson's first electric guitar, the ES-150, was produced in 1936, and in 1946, Gibson introduced the P90X, just joking, the P90 single coil pickup, which was eventually used on the first Les Paul model made in 1952. I don't know if you can tell, but I have no idea what I just read.
Really?
Guitars were made by Les Paul.
Old guitar, not by Les Paul. Les Paul was, well, eventually.
Whatever. Eventually.
Eventually.
Gibson, whatever.
Gibson.
Anyway.
October 11th, 2009. We went from 1902 to 2009.
Yeah, that was fun. That was good.
Barbra Streisand went to number one on the U.S. album charts with Love is the Answer, Streisand's ninth number one album, making her the only artist to have a number one album in America in five different decades.
October 12th, 1955, born on this day, my girl, my other girl other than Tiffany, Jane Siberry, Canadian singer-songwriter. She had the 1989 album Bound by the Beauty and, of course, the amazing song Mimi on the Beach. Up to the open sky, down the shining sea again, and back to me. And Mimi on the beach, Mimi on the beach, Mimi on the beach. Mimi on the beach, Mimi on the beach, Mimi and me.
October 13th, 1974. Unfortunately, Ed Sullivan died, leader of the Ed Sullivan Singers and Orchestra. He introduced the Beatles and other UK acts to America via his Ed Sullivan TV show from New York City, which ran from 1948 to 1971. Was Ed Sullivan the one where they had to cut off Elvis's, or
yes,
film him from the waist,
yeah,
up?
From the waist up. And his other thing was, it's a really big show. We got a really big show for
big
you tonight.
Show.
Yeah.
Well, R.I.P.
A long shoe.
Where was he from that made his accent that way?
Probably the East Coast of the U.S.
Oh, okay.
Listeners can tell us, because we don't know how to Google.
October 14th, 72, Michael Jackson went to number one on the singles chart with Ben, his first solo number one, which was also a number seven hit in the U.K.
And what was Ben about?
A boy.
Boy.
No.
Oh, gross. We both... Ben, his monkey.
Close.
His giraffe. His camel.
No.
His brother.
No.
His dad.
No.
His cousin.
No.
Big Ben.
No.
I got
this is a nice lead up to our show coming up in about 3 weeks.
Halloween.
Do you remember that movie that came out recently called Willard with all the rats?
No.
It's based off an old horror movie called Ben the Horror Rat. Michael Jackson wrote Ben for the killer rat in that movie, even though it sounds like a love song.
That's gross.
Food for thought. Gross.
Michael Jackson, SMH.
I just need it to be
SMH.
Shake my head.
October 15th, 1979. ABBA.
I love ABBA.
Played their first concert in North America, where they appeared
naked
in Vancouver, British Columbia.
Their first show in North America
was in Vancouver. Isn't that awesome?
That's
cool.
Amazing.
Way to go, Vancouver. October 16th, 2006. CBGB, the legendary New York punk club credited with discovering Patti Smith and the Ramones, closed after a final gig by Smith herself. Blondie and Talking Heads also found fame after performing at the club, which helped launch U.S. punk music. The venue first opened in December 1973. Its full name, CBGB OMFUG, standing for Country, Bluegrass, Blues, and Other Music for Uplifting, blah, blah. Country, Bluegrass, Blues, and Other Music for Uplifting Gourmandizers?
Gourmandizers, yeah.
Gourmandizers. And there's also a movie featuring Leonard Hofstadter. What's his real name?
Oh, I don't know his real name. From Big Bang Theory.
Johnny Galecki.
Johnny Galecki.
Was he Leonard? Yeah, you're right.
Yeah,
I had the wrong actor in my head.
Also known for his fame in Roseanne. And Christmas Vacation.
Yeah.
Anyway, he's going to be in a movie that's coming out about CBGB.
And that has been This Week in Music History. Have a musically historical week.
You're alone on that one. That was funny.
Damn it.
You need to write them. Welcome to This Week on the Charts. And today I wanted to take a look at the question of, do I need to have a song on the radio charts in order to be on the top album charts? And this week I have the list of the top 10 Canadian albums, and I have a couple of facts about the songs from those albums and if they're on the charts in Canada. And so here we go. Number one, the number one album in Canada is Drake's Nothing Was the Same. A song from that album right now, Hold On, is number four on the CHR, Canadian Radio CHR charts. Number two, Kings of Leon, Mechanical Bull. They have a single that's number one on the Canadian rock charts, so that totally makes sense why they'd be number two on the album charts. We have Jack Johnson, From Here to Now to You. He's the number third album in Canada, but he is not charting at all on Canadian radio. He's charting in the U.S. on AAA radio, so that's a very interesting thing to know. And we also had a conversation about maybe why he's selling so well in our podcast last week, and part of it is to do with his audience being an older audience and the loyal following that he has, so he doesn't technically need radio airplay. Number four, Avicii and his album True. The single Wake Me Up is huge, and you probably already know that if you listen to radio or pay attention to pop culture. It's charting on the Hot AC and CHR radio charts right now in Canada. Number five, we have Dream Theater with their album Dream Theater. It's not charting on Canadian or U.S. commercial radio, which again is really interesting to know. I know that they have a loyal following, and that could probably be the answer why they're selling so well. Number six, we have Matthew Good with Arrows of Desire. Right now, Matthew Good has two singles from that album charting on the Canadian rock radio charts. So that, again, would explain probably why his album is number six in Canada. Number seven, we have Elton John with The Diving Board. That, I believe, came out a week or two ago. And Elton John is not currently charting with a single on Canadian radio. He is charting with his single Home Again at number 14 on U.S. AC radio. So that is another example of an artist that has a loyal following, and hence why the sales may be so good. Number eight, we have The Weeknd with Kiss Land. No single currently charting on radio, Canada or US. Number nine, we have Metallica with The Never. It's a soundtrack, no current single out. And number 10, Vincent, and I hope I don't say this wrong, but Valier with Fabrique Love. It's really French. So I probably butchered that, and I apologize to anybody that's listening that speaks French, but there is airplay for that single on radio in Quebec. So the album that I just named is number 10 on the top 10 Canadian albums with a single playing in Quebec. So that kind of gives you an idea of what the top 10 Canadian albums have going on elsewhere in Canada, and something that you should pay attention to if you're a musician, if you work in the music industry, or if you just find this kind of stuff interesting, because it's giving us a glimpse of what, you know, what is working. So, for example, The Weeknd, without a single out right now, what is The Weeknd doing? Who's talking about them? Is it support from other artists? Is he featured on another artist's song? that recently charted. So different things like that, or you know, why is Jack Johnson charting, even though he doesn't have, or why is his album charting even though he doesn't have a single out in Canada? That's it for this week on the charts.
Yes, they are.
The old buildings with the leaves. Is this recording?
Yes.
Oh. So since we're talking about campuses, so this week we're looking at the last 40 of the top 50 for the campus report. Number 40, Paper Maps, Darker Lights. 41, Cousins / Construction and Deconstruction. 42, Dr. Dog, B Room. 43, Linda Ortega, The Star, Tin Star. 44, Ockerville River, The Silver Gymnasium. 45, Washed Out Paracosm. 46, Fur Trade, Don't Get Heavy. 47, Grand Analog, Modern Thunder. 48, Hermetic, Heartbreakology. 49, Chelsea Wolfe, Pain is Beautiful. And number 50, Still Life Still, Morning Terrace. So those are the songs that are on the top 50 report that have the fewest amount of plays, but we should still pay attention to them. And isn't it funny to look at the names of those bands and the people and the albums? They're quite different than if you look at like a pop chart where it's just people's names, don't you think?
I agree.
Okay. Have a great week listening to Campus.
It's a pretty quiet week in music tech, but I have a couple of quick iTunes updates for people. Not specifically iTunes the app, but iTunes Festival, it is over, and you can still go to catch some of the amazing performances for free. Some of the expected faces were there, like Ellie Goulding, Robin Thicke, or Lady Gaga, but there were some pretty cool unexpected performers, including one of my all-time favorites, the Pixies. Also, strangely there, Sigur Rós, Primal Scream, and likely up-and-comer Iggy Azalea. So if you have an iTunes account, you can check them out in the store. Also, in iTunes news, iTunes Radio will launch in Canada early next year, ahead of Pandora's planned launch. Now, Pandora's been around since 2000, but never inked any deals to stream in Canada until iTunes Radio appeared, or if they did, they took a long time. So it might be a case of too little, too late. We'll see in 2014 who succeeds, but personally, I hope it's RDO, who is here first and is a great service anyways. And that has been your Music Tech Update. Hopefully next week it will be a bit more diverse. Yes.
This week we have a song from a band we're working with, a Toronto band that we are absolutely in love with, and the guys are Neverist. Neverist is a band that showed up on the scene a couple of years ago, and we've mentioned them in one of our previous podcasts because we're currently working their most recent single called Rewind. And so like I mentioned, when they came out a couple of years ago, their first single, About Us, went gold. And that is just something almost unheard of for a group, a musician, or whoever in Canada to have with their first release. And they've had such amazing support from their label and their management, as well as having Howie D of the Backstreet Boys manage them, has been such an awesome thing to see and has been such a great way to get them in the forefront of a lot of people's minds. And it doesn't hurt that the tracks that they release are fantastic. So this week we thought it'd be a lot of fun to throw back to that single, About Us, because this week Neverist announced some tour dates they're doing in November with Sean Desmond, and they're going to be doing that in Eastern Canada, and it's in November. I think I mentioned that. But also, the guys are taking part in a lot of Wee Day festivities in Atlantic Canada, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, and Montreal. You can see all of those dates on their websites, as well as the Wee Day websites. And for more information on the Sean Desmond and Neverist tour dates, you can take a look at those on neveristmusic.com. Also, Sean Desmond's website would have it available. So here we go. Here's a little throwback for Neverist with their single, About Us.
Seems like everything is happening again. It's the same old story. People keep on getting in my
trying to do this for me. I'm tired of chancing everything and putting all this on me. It's breaking every little piece of me, and I don't ever want you to leave. Why couldn't it just be a one way, so I can give you affection? Never thought I'd see the day. It's not fair for me to choose. It's not easy to explain. You'd have to walk in my shoes. I'm trying to make it right, this thing that they call love.
This week I had a chance to talk to Andy Curran, who is at Anthem SRO. He works with Rush, with The Reason, and is a member of Coney Hatch as well. We got to talk about management, we got to talk about A&R, and here's the conversation we had here on Radio Dale. So,
rock and roll.
Rock and roll. Speaking of rock and roll, I guess, could you go over, I'm not going to say ask you what you do. Mm-hmm. I think it would be more interesting to hear sort of what a typical day would be like. So if you're having a nice busy day, what kind of stuff might you be up to?
Well, I guess that's the challenging part of the job, and it also keeps it interesting, mm-hmm. is that on any given day, I could be working with the guys in Rush, let's say. One of the highlights of working at SRO and Anthem for me was being involved in the process to help choose the producer of the last couple of Rush records.
Oh, nice.
So when I went into a meeting with those guys and they handed me a list of candidates to get in touch with, everybody from Brian Eno to Daniel Lanois, mm-hmm. and then at the end of that, I go, okay, yeah, this is cool. I might be calling John Paul Jones, right? And then getting up, and they said, oh, no, the meeting's not done. Who do you think we should work with? So I'm pretty proud of the fact that I introduced the guys to Nick Raskulinich,
okay.
and he produced the last couple Rush records. So on a very high-end level, mm-hmm. I could be working on stuff like that, really involved with the iPad app for Rush as well.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit on day-to-day management stuff with them. Currently, we're just doing a DVD, so I'm involved at the process with A&R of making sure the mixes and coordinating the mixes, making sure they all came out great and 5-1. So there's a whole QC process after listening. So that's currently on my desk right now. We're just putting to bed the new Live Rush DVD. And there was some remixes for Vapor Trails, a record that was a bit of a problem child for the band. And so introduced the guys to the concept of bringing back David Bottrell, who they were talking to mix the record or work with them way back when they recorded Vapor Trails. So anyway, he did a fantastic job of remixing Vapor Trails. And then on the other end of the spectrum, we have a band called The Reason. Mm. So they're a young band that... we're trying to get them up and get their head above the pack. So literally doing budgets and day-to-day stuff with getting them across Canada in a van and a trailer, helping them with merch ideas. You know, what's the most cost-effective way to do merch? There's another band coming over to tour with them. Can we share gear? So like the nuts and bolts of touring. A small band, or a young band would be a better word, a young band like The Reason, who are quite early in their career, and then working on the far end spectrum with the band like Rush 40 years into their career. So, crazy stuff like, hey, we need to book hotels, and then somebody, needs to book rehearsal time, or we're doing ad mats for... posters or ad mats for promotions with Rush, with DW Drums. So you never know what's going to get thrown on you on a day-to-day basis. A lot of it with artist management is trying to talk guys down off the shelf if they're panicking about stuff. So
actually, that's funny because I was going to say, first off, it sounds like there's a lot of creative but also logistical side to everything that you're doing.
Yeah.
And also the sort of stereotype of a management side of things is that a lot of it is babysitting, which I think is kind of a patronizing way of putting it, but you kind of feel that has, like, sort of being a coach or being sort of a mentor is a big element of being a manager.
Yeah, I would say you're absolutely right. When, as a parent who actually has real children, there is that coaching element and just propping them up when they do something really great, but if something goes astray, being vocal about it. So I think that, you know, when Ray hired me 8 years ago, part of my upbringing was absolutely on the other side of the desk of being a musician, recording, touring. So I think the perspective that I could lend to artists on our roster, maybe not so much Rush because they've been doing it a little bit longer than I have, but with the Tea Party and Big Wreck and Ian Thornley and The Reason, I see lots of scenarios go down. So I try to weigh in on them and be objective about stuff that I have gone through. But absolutely, I wouldn't call it babysitting, more coaching and being a sounding board for them. And a lot of times I'm very quick to tell people, it's your career and it's your... You're the person who's going to make the final call. But... just from my point of view, here's what I think we might want to entertain. Even a guy like Stephen Page with the Bare Naked Ladies, who's been really successful and has his own solo career, Stephen and I will have discussions where it'll be like, okay, well, what do you think? This is what I think we should do. So it's a give and take, but the babysitting part, I wouldn't call it babysitting, but it takes up a lot of hours. Like that, like the logistical stuff is very time consuming. The creative stuff is the fun stuff. That's the stuff that I love about the job, but the nuts and bolts of it can be very, very challenging, let's say.
Cool.
Yeah.
What was the transition like from musician? Not really that it's been a transition because it's ongoing, but from musician to being, like you said, on the other side of the table. Maybe start off with how you got into music and a bit of your career leading up to when you found yourself working for musicians as well as being a musician.
Well, the transition I can remember, to answer that question first, I was definitely in shock for about the first month going, what have I done here? Because Ray had been courting me for quite some time to come and work with him. And Ray and I first met in 1982 when he signed my first band, Coney Hatch, to a record deal and management. And we remained friends over all of those years. And many years later, in the 90s, he asked me to come and work for him when I had my solo band. And I said I wasn't done rocking and playing. And eventually realized that it was a good move for me. And my experience might pay off to work with other bands. But the transition was tough because I'd never had a real gig, so to speak. I guess in the sort of twilight of my playing years, I was doing a lot of production, and the production turned more into writing. Then started writing music for TSN and Insight Productions and TV stuff, and getting involved with mixing and mastering and producing records. So the transition seemed like a natural one to me. It was less playing live, into studio stuff, into going to work for a record company, management company. Yeah. But I'll admit it was tough. Like, I remember the first week, one of the first weeks I was there, and a girl at the office said, hey, it's a long weekend this weekend. And I was like, my entire career has been a long weekend, right? Like, this, tell me something good. But going to an office day after day, the same place, was quite a hard thing for me to wrap my head around, because being a musician, you know, is being a little bit of a nomad. You're either working out of your home or you're on the road. So that was a tough concept for me to wrap my head around too. I'm going back to the office again. Here I am. I'm back at the office, right? So I like to do a lot of meetings outside and spice up the day a little bit by not being in the office all the time. But the career is a lengthy one, so it might be too long for this interview.
Yeah, that's all right. How about just we'll start at the very beginning. We know with Coney Hatch, but prior to that, how did you get introduced to music? What's your sort of earliest memory of I want to be in music?
Well, there's two good stories I can tell you. One, music was always around my family. My dad played a few instruments, guitar and piano, and my grandpa was in the first ever BBC orchestra in England and played trumpet, and later was a big band leader and went on to teach music. So there's always been music around me, and my sisters used to listen to Chum AM and have the transistor radios and be blasting the Beatles and the Monkees. That's my earliest memory. And I would play tennis racket guitar, and they would be the go-go dancers. So that was that was my first band. But I think it was maybe my 17th or 18th birthday, one of my sister's boyfriends gave me a Hofner Beetle bass for my birthday, because he knew I loved music. I had a pretty big record collection. And then I just started trying to lift the bass parts on my own and started getting into playing bass and formed a couple little basement bands. But Coney Hatch was a band that I started in the late, like 79, 80, which had a six-year span up to about 85. And then I did a couple solo records on my own with Andy Curran, and then Soho 69. And then after that was Drug Plan and Leisure World and Caramel, where I had some, at least got lucky enough to have record, U.S. Record deals with Geffen and Artist Direct. And that led into me working at Anthem and SRO. So I still write and play music and have a studio at home. It's something that's in my blood, and I can't get rid of it.
Yeah.
I've tried several times to squelch it, but it's not working.
Something that a lot of people, I know there are many people that listen to the podcast, they're interested in either being in the music industry or they're indie musicians. And one of the things that I've learned in my career, and also talking to people, is that there is a lot more jumping around now, either between careers or as artists between bands, than there seemed to be previously. Do you agree with that? And do you think that that's a good thing, that people are sort of jumping from, not from job to job, but essentially career to career, moving through the industry that way?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting what you brought up, Root, because I remember my first band thinking, this band's going on forever. Like, when I was in Coney Hatch, I had no idea. I was like, this is what I do. This is my band. We'll play forever. And when that band broke up, it was a rude awakening to go, oh my God, what else can I do? And I like to call it supplementing your music career, because there's been some crazy jobs that I've had to do over the years to supplement my income that afforded me the opportunity to still try to be in the music business and write and tour and make records. So I've got an interesting theory that, well, it's double fold. One, as long as people continue to support you and give you budgets and opportunities to tour or make records, then you have a music career. Mm-hmm. But I'm a strong believer that you shouldn't just rely on that. And my dad kind of instilled it in me, like, what's your backup plan? What are you going to do? Mm-hmm. So if you've got other talents that you can do that generate money while you're doing your music career, if it's a successful music career, there's usually that point where you go, I don't have to work at the burger place anymore.
Yeah.
I don't have to deliver pizzas.
Yeah.
I'm doing full on music. And a lot of, well, most of the acts on our roster are all full-time musicians. And there are some of them that are still trying to supplement with other stuff. I don't think it's a bad thing to be a jack of a few different trades.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's good.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
You mentioned the iPad app. Mm-hmm. And generally, there is a movement towards either sort of more responsive websites, how people are using social media is sort of changing.
Yep.
The word content marketing comes up a lot about how whether musicians should make videos like vlogs or blog or anything like that. How important do you feel digital is to musicians today?
It's becoming increasingly more important to, mm-hmm. to have visibility there. When I first started in Coney Hatch, there was nothing like that. You relied on interviews and videos that you made in the traditional sense, like videos on Much Music or mm-hmm. MTV. And that we got our breaks because MTV was a fledgling company at that point, asking for videos. Do you have any you could send
us? I guess that was, 81, 82
yeah.
is when it started
out.
Yeah.
And I can remember touring in the States and turning it on and seeing our videos in there with, you know, like the cream of the crop with Michael Jackson mm-hmm. and the Police and Rush and all those bands, because yeah. there was a lack of videos. To me now, there's a flood of content, and Much Music and MTV are not what I would call music channels. So mm-hmm. to me, I think it's important that artists are proactive in making sure that there's content on their websites that their fans can enjoy. As a fan, I'll go to visit certain websites and go, I wonder what's new. I wonder what they're mm-hmm. up to. And I think that fresh input of content is really good. And I think, especially with the demise of music channels, so to speak, mm-hmm. you have to do it yourself. So the music channel yeah. has become the band's website. With a band like Rush and the iPad app, Geddy Lee is a big fan of the Major League Baseball app, and he was like, man, this is awesome. I would love to give our fans a version of this
yeah.
so that they have their own sort of Major League Baseball app, but it's a Rush app,
yeah.
and there's all kinds of fun things on it. So the more I work with bands like Rush and Stephen Page's audience is like this, a little bit with the Tea Party too, mm-hmm. their fans are diehard. They want everything that they can get. So if there's an app out there that you can add to the list, why not?
Yeah.
And that usually connects. I mean, on you would know this, but on the mm-hmm. technical end of it, the information that's being looked at on an app is yeah. being pushed out through our website.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
it's constantly updated. When you go to the app, there are things that are permanent on it with music and certain fun games, but
yeah.
the content of going that's the one-stop shopping. I'm going to go to the Rush app. What's the latest in news?
Mm-hmm.
I think it gives a convenient way for fans to keep up on things if they can't go to the website.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
In today's age, what do you feel is the role of A&R in management compared to before? Because it used to be, obviously, back in the day, mm-hmm. A&R pretty much found artists, gave them songs, and
yep.
push them out. And management kind of led people around and made sure that they
yeah.
got places. Do you feel that it's the same now, or has it changed?
I think it's changed a little bit in
mm-hmm.
terms of when I first started in the music industry. It seemed like there was a lot more record labels that were spending money developing acts. So
mm-hmm.
they would, you would hear about a band get signed, and then they would take them into the studio and spend some money on them, put them together with producers or songwriters.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes those projects would be successful, but oftentimes I would hear about labels that would sign a band or an artist and work on them and then go, yeah, that's not happening. I don't see a lot of development now with labels and or management companies
mm-hmm.
taking a risk and going, that's a really cool band, but they need to work on A, B, and C. So I've tried to encourage that, but I can see the model changing where even our label and our management company, if we get something put in front of us and a lot of it is done already, it's like, this is amazing. Mm-hmm. They've got mm-hmm. their first record done. They have photos. They got their website.
Their fan base is already built up. Yeah.
So that becomes an attractive thing to pick up. Mm-hmm. And you're like, wow, they've done it all themselves. I love the development part, and I have found a few artists and convinced the company to spend a little bit of money and take them into the studio and see if there's something there. Mm-hmm. But certainly for me, on a personal level with A&R, I always find I try to make it look like Ian Thornley and Big Rec is a perfect situation. Mm-hmm. One of the most talented guys that I've ever met in my life. Mm-hmm. And I don't think he needs a traditional A&R guy. His instincts are great, so I try to surround him with the people that I think he should be working with, mm-hmm. that he can make his best record. I would never advocate to him, let's go put you together in Nashville with a songwriter, because he writes amazing songs.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like the old traditional A&R. It's like, okay, let me get my fingers in here and let me change things up. I actually try to be less hands-on, mm-hmm. and let the artists do what they want. And if I see it steering in a different road, I'll go, hey, no, what? Let's do this, or let's work with that guy, or this producer, or that mixer. But I try not to get in and get my hands dirty on stuff. I would rather the artists do that.
Yeah.
So that's where I would say babysitting is a good word.
Yeah.
I babysit the situation and try to be not very aggressive about it, and let it take its shape in the studio, you know?
Yeah. If somebody, an indie artist right now, was wanting to get started and wanted to move to the next level, they have put songs up on YouTube and on SoundCloud, they've maybe played a couple of shows in Toronto, mm-hmm. what do you think is the biggest thing that they should be paying attention to sort of maybe get the attention of somebody that might want to bring them in?
Good question. Two things. One, they should not pay attention to what other bands are doing. Mm-hmm. I find far too many bands are looking over their shoulders going, well, this band's doing that and that band's doing this, and how come they're getting this exposure and we're not? It's just like, hone your own sound, mm-hmm. make your thing that special, that much more special. And yes, you can go out and see what the competition's like, but I'm a big advocate of not rubbernecking and seeing what your neighbor's doing. Just make your thing great, and that'll make it stand out. Mm-hmm. So that's what not to do. I definitely think getting a little bit of a buzz around with, if you can start drawing some consistent crowds in clubs, that's mm-hmm. great, because agents will hear about it, and agents usually call managers and labels. Like, most of the bands that I hear about, I hear through our agents. Or they're like, hey, so-and-so just sold out the Horseshoe for the fourth or fifth time in a row, and they have no record deal, and they have no management. And then before you know it, all the weasels are chasing the ambulance and going down, going, who is this
band? Actually seen that happen before, yeah. I've watched that happen.
That's done all
it's
this
funny.
Stuff on their own, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, doing the early heavy lifting and creating a buzz that way, especially in a live end, like, we hear about that stuff really fast.
Mm-hmm.
And I might sound jaded, but when I first started, I would go out to clubs randomly. And I don't do that anymore now, because, you know, I'd sit through four or five bands in a night, and one of them would be great, and I was like, I'm gonna look like I'm 100 years old if I continue to do this all year. So going and mining the clubs and trying to maybe find a gem out there, I tried that for a year and it didn't work out too well for me. So now I like that process you're talking about, the osmosis of the buzz happening. I'll keep my ear to the ground and find out who's making the noise. And it doesn't matter whether it's Winnipeg or Calgary or... Mm-hmm. You know, I've flown out to a lot of cities far away if I heard somebody's making a good splash somewhere.
Nice.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you very much.
All right, buddy.
Awesome.
And that has been Radio Dale number 42. My name is Rue.
I'm India.
And I'm Amber.
If you'd like to find us online, we're at dalespeaking.com. We're on Twitter at dale_speaking. You can email us at radiodale@dalespeaking.com. Anything else? Any last words? Any thoughts?
Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Be Thanksgiving.
Full.
Full.
And if you're in Erin,
Ontario,
or passing through Erin, Ontario, head to the Erin Fall Fair.
Oh.
say hi.
That sounds fun.
It's lots of fun. There's going to be... Oh, my nephew's in a demolition derby.
Oh.
So show up Sunday night and cheer on Matt.
Is it not the tractor the demolition pool? Derby.
No, he's backing his car into other people.
Oh, yeah.
So that's good.
Pedestrians. We run people over in this car.
And Aaron, yeah. So it's going to be lots of fun.
That's
there.
Fun.
And they have T-Mail bacon too. So there you go. Everything you need to know about Thanksgiving.
Derbies and P-Meal bacon in Aaron, Ontario. Sweet.
I think that's it. Bye.
Until next week.
October
13th, 1974. TV host Ed Sullivan died. Oh, I thought it was going to be something different. I didn't know it was that he died. Okay, start that over.
No.
October 13th, 1974. TV host Ed Sullivan died. I still read it horribly. Okay.